For today's main message, our pastor will be delivering a message entitled, Dealing with Tragedy.
Thank you, Richard, and greetings once again to those who may be just tuning in on the cybercast. And thank you, Lynn, for passing out the little yellow sheets, which are for the children, questions and answers, which I make up for each sermon. I try to make up for each sermon, and I hope that the parents will take them home and teach the children a little bit from them and give them something to think about. Wayne is the owner of the cottage that we rent on Shuswap Lake. He knows I'm a minister. Within about 10 minutes of our initial conversation, when I was picking up the key, I asked him how things were going. He told me his father-in-law committed suicide in March, 68 years of age. He was ill, had had an accident of some kind, his back was bad, and so on and so forth. Didn't think he was useful any longer, and he committed suicide. He told me a friend of his, third wife, left him. His third marriage failed. His wife left him. He hung himself in April and died. He found out that another friend of his has been committing adultery for 5 years on his wife. That ended that friendship, he said. At the end of June, on the very lot where this little cabin is, at the corner of the lot, there's a group of trees, and Wayne lives right beside, across the street from that. There's a 16-year-old girl named Lahina Dawn who died in a highway accident right in those trees. I can still see the marks where the automobile hit the trees. It must have been going at a terrible rate of speed. 16-year-old girl that they all knew in a small community died, and of course others were injured there. And at the spring as well, his son broke up with a longtime girlfriend of his. Wayne said to me, he says, I came that close to starting to pray. None of these people really have a belief. They don't go to church. And when tragedy strikes, they don't know what to do. Now, he did say, well, in my own way, I do pray. And I'm not sure what that meant exactly. I don't believe it means getting down on his knees in a heartfelt cry to God. That close to praying. And it's an amazing thing how tragedy strikes people, you know, and they just don't have anywhere to go if they don't have an anchor. Something to hope for, and many of them then drift, and some take their lives. I asked him, we talked a bit more about the fire, and he says, you know, if my house burns, and the cottage he has on the lake, which he rents, so he says, then I've lost everything, and I'm not sure what I would do then, because we were talking about the fires and so on. And so I said to him, everything? You have a beautiful wife, you have two very healthy sons, you have this land, you have a job, you're a healthy person yourself. What's your definition of everything? Well, and he acknowledged that's true. That was far more important than his house, and far more important than his boats, far more important than the cottage, far more important than anything was his wife and his children. So the house wouldn't have been everything. And yet, you know, when people are interviewed with the Kelowna fires, you hear so many of them break down in tears and say, we've lost everything. And when you think you've lost everything, something happens to you inside. You get depressed. You get down in the dumps. You begin feeling that life is terrible. Wayne went on to say it has been a bad year. In everyone's life, tragedies do strike. They're guaranteed to strike in your life. Tragedies are going to strike. The question is, what do you do? How do you handle tragedies? You know, how do you make the most to it? How do you develop something strong? How do you become strong? If you've lost a house, a home, a car, lost financial gain of some kind, you've lost things, then you've lost something. No question of that. If you've lost your health, or if you've lost a husband or a wife, or a mother or father, or grandfather or grandmother, or if you've lost a friend, then you've lost very much. But if you've lost your spiritual mooring, then you've lost everything. That's when you've lost everything. If you lose what we could say your life and your being, or your life and your soul, then you can say you've lost everything. How can we prepare for the inevitable in life, the tragedies that are going to strike? How can we be strong when severe trials come to us all? Because life does deal in trials and in difficulties. The man that I believe faced more tragedies than you and I ever will in our lifetime is Job. And I'm going to start by going to quickly to some scriptures of showing how he coped with these points. And I'm only going to take a few of the points in this book. But in Job chapter 1, starting in verse 20, Job lost, apparently, many of his children, if not all. It's interesting, scripture a little further on in Job, I won't go to it, where it talks about his wife and his children. So it seems he may have had a few left anyway. He lost all of his children at that given point. And he lost his financial well-being, and he lost his friends, his family turned against him. He lost his health. But he was still alive. He came to a frame of thought. Verse 20 of Job chapter 1, verse 20. Job arose, he tore his robe, that's a sign of sorrow, a sign of expression of deep pain. He shaved his head, and he fell on the ground, and he worshipped God. He did not lose his spiritual anchor, his spiritual mooring. And he said, "Naked I have come from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with anything. You know, on the day of a person's death, they do in fact lose their mate and their children and all of their children and all of their financial wealth and their homes and anything they've saved up. They leave everything behind. You take nothing with you to the grave where you go. So ultimately, you know, we're born with nothing and we die, leaving everything behind. So we are facing that. We do face that. We face that inevitability of life. And we learn it from watching our grandparents and our parents who die. My father was 60 years old when he died in 1960. I was right by his bedside. I remember the moment very clearly in my mind. But I learned a great deal from that. When that vibrant person stopped breathing, or life stopped, I learned some very important lessons. And of course, with my wife Joan, much the same. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. There was a spiritual anchor. And that's an important point for Job. And it's an important point for you and I. That's why we gather together, to understand these points. Chapter 3, just a few more verses here. Verse 1, "After this, Job opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth." He was so down at times, he said, verse 11, "Why didn't I die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb?" But you know, there were questions he was asking in there too. What's the purpose of life? What's the reason of all of this? What am I supposed to learn, is what Job was asking. "Why did the knees receive me, or the breasts that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I'd have been asleep. Then would I have had rest." He goes on saying in verse 23, "Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, to whom God has hedged in? For my sighting comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes." So it isn't wrong to understand, you know, that trials can be very upsetting. Tragedies will hurt you from the top of your head to the bottom of your little toe. You'll feel it. And you'll feel it for years, maybe all the rest of your life. And there's things we are to learn from this as well. Now, Job said he wish he hadn't been born. It is a sin to take your own life. Suicide is a sin. It's a wrong thing to do. Chapter 6 of Job and verse 24. Chapter 6. Job was willing to learn. He was willing to learn. And he examined himself too. He says in verse 24, "Teach me, and I will hold my tongue." He wanted to learn. "Cause me to understand where I've made a mistake or where I have erred. What have I done wrong? How forceful are right words, but what does your arguing prove?" His friends were not teaching him. They were not convincing him. But he was willing to learn. In chapter 7, in verse 11, he goes on to state that he talked with God about his condition. And he asked God why. He asked God, "Why is this happening? What is the purpose of life? Why do you test me every moment Every morning you're there. You don't let go of me, Job is asking. And of course the answer is there has to be a tremendous and an awesome reason and purpose for that occurring and happening. God does not do anything for no reason. And when you think of being a member of the very family of God, from being human, scaling above the angels to this vast difference, becoming a member of the family of God, it is an awesome future that God's offering. Not lightly given and not lightly offered, and worth everything that we could do to be a part of that. So Job is asking, he says in verse 11, Therefore I will not restrain my mouth, I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions. You know, the mind doesn't stop. Our mind runs ahead and rushes ahead and sees all things even before they happen, and we worry about it in advance and so on. And we get these dreams and these visions, and sometimes they can be very, very upsetting to people. And yet, you know, we do understand that our brain is constantly working and usually just spitting out that which we've put into it. You know, some of the horrifying movies that they make these days or some of the things I see children looking at, you know, that's there. It's imprinted. It's going to come out one day too. He said, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I will not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. So he says, you know, I'm getting older. I can see it. And then he says, what is man that you should exalt him? What is man that you should lift him up and do something with him and give him control over all that's around him? That you should set your heart on him. Why do you want us? What are we that you are concerned about us, that you want to do something with us, that you should visit him every morning? What do you think about first thing in the morning when you open your eyes? I'm not sure. Some people wake up differently. You know, I wake up right away. My eyes are open right away, and I think right away. I have a piece of pencil sometimes and a paper by the bed, or I get ideas. I've got to get up and get downstairs and write them down before I forget. Valerie wakes up slowly, in stages. You know, she comes down and she sort of, like she's hypnotized a little bit. And that's okay. Everybody's a bit different, you see. I wake up right away. But you should visit him every morning. I think about God right off the bat. Godly things, godly thoughts. Almost immediately, as soon as I open my eyes, it seems that I think about ideas for articles. I'm lying in bed then just for just a minute. I can't lie in bed for very long. If I'm wide awake, I get up. You visit him every morning and you test him every moment. Why does God test humans every moment? Why does he test you every day? With your conduct with each other, for example, getting along with your neighbor, learning to love your neighbor, problems that are financial, forest fires, or difficulties with your trip, you know, your boat that doesn't start for you, or water leaks in, or whatever is occurring and happening. Why does this always happen to us? Why does it test us every moment? How long will you not look away from me? Why don't you just turn your head for a little while? He's asking God. And let me alone until I swallow my spit or saliva. Have I sinned? And he was examining himself. Job, see the lessons he was learning? He was examining himself. Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? And why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust and you will seek me diligently, but I won't be there. I'll be dead, he is saying. Now, since Job, we understand that the death of Jesus Christ has, in fact, rescued us and saved us. Job understood a lot of things, though, too. Job 10 and verse 8. Job said, your hands have made me and fashioned me. I'm not an accident of some lightning strike in a swamp or a slough. You made me. You made me to think. You made me to be as I am. You developed us as humans. And we do think. And we take 20 years to grow up. And children need moms and dads that whole span of time. Your hands have made me and fashioned me. You know, humans are marvelous. Marvelous. The difference between a human and all other creatures is so great. It's absolutely marvelous. Mainly it has to do with thinking, with feeling, with experiencing, with being able to laugh and being able to cry, being able to feel things, being able to worry. Your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity. Yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you've made me like clay, he says, and will you turn me to dust again? That's what happens when you die. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You've given me, or you've granted me life and favor, and your care has preserved my spirit. So Job says life has been wonderful, and it was for him a wonderful experience. And it is to be for you too, and me, in spite of the tragedies. How can we make it that way? How can we have life as an adventure? There are ways that we can do that. He says in verse 13, all these things you've hidden in your heart, and I know that this was with you. If I sin, you mark me and will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I'm wicked, woe to me. Even if I'm righteous, I cannot lift my head. I am full of disgrace. So we cannot clear ourselves in God. We need the sacrifice of Jesus Christ to do that. And Job became to understand some of these points. Chapter 14 of Job. And verse 1, he says, man who is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. And he says in verse 13, oh, that you'd hide me in the grave. You'd conceal me till your wrath is past, and you'd appoint me a set time and remember me. This is in the middle of the greatest tragedy and trial that I think anybody could go through. But then Job turns to his strength, and he says, if a man dies, that's when you possibly lose everything. Will he live again? He says, all the days of my hard service I will wait. Till my change comes, you shall call. He knew that. I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover my iniquity. But as a mountain falls and crumbles away, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears down stones and torrents wash away the soil of the earth, in verse 19, so you destroy the hope of man. You prevail forever against him. He passes on. You change his countenance and send him away. His sons come to honor. He doesn't know it. They're brought low. He doesn't perceive it. But his flesh will be in pain over it, and his soul will mourn over it. Job knew there was a purpose in life. Didn't always know what it was. He trusted God in that there was a great reason that he was born. And he learned. You can read the rest of the book. Let's go to Job 42 just to see the closing portion of what he had learned. Job 42, Job answered God and said, I know you can do everything. And no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. And you asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Now Job had a lot of knowledge, but not all knowledge. There were huge gaps missing the purpose of life and why the tragedies would occur and happen in his life. And what was he to learn from all of this? But he was learning tremendously. Therefore I have uttered which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. So listen, please, and let me speak. You said I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, and I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. And so it was after the Lord had spoken these words to Job that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. And the end result was that Job had learned so much that he could now intervene for his friends. He could now help his family and help his friends. Therefore, take for yourselves seven bulls and seven rams. Go to my servant Job. Offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you. I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has. So what Job said was right, that he was unjustly treated, and that he didn't know why this was happening to him, that all these trials came. Every minute he was having trials, every morning God was there, and he was asking why. God said what he said was right. So the Eliphaz and the others then did what God commanded, and God had accepted Job. And then God restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends. His friends had all forsaken him and turned away from him, and so on. He lost his family and his friends and everything. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. When I say everything, I'm not saying everything in the sense that his spiritual life was lost, but the physical things were lost. He gave him twice as much as he had before. And all his brothers and sisters and those who had been his acquaintances came to him, ate food with him, consoled him, comforted him for all the adversity the Lord had brought him. Each one gave him a piece of silver and a ring of gold, and he blessed the latter more than the beginning. And Job prayed for them, prayed for his brothers and sisters and friends. One of the really great lessons of life for God's people is that we are to learn from suffering. All people suffer. This man I told you about, Wayne, not a particularly religious man at all, but he's hurting. And his friend hung himself, and his father-in-law hung himself. But people hurt, and people suffer without God. So being religious doesn't mean you're going to suffer. We suffer whether we're religious or not. And life hurts us, whether we are religious or not. But when we follow the footsteps of Jesus Christ, who also suffered, then we can learn something great and make something out of life, which is very, very precious and very special. I've come up with 12 points on how to deal with tragedies, what we are to be doing, what we ought to be doing, and I'm sure you can alter them, or vary them, or add to them, or maybe combine some of them, so however it pleases you. But these are the ones that came to my mind as I was writing and thinking about it. And many of them come from sort of one section, and one of them are certainly from the words of God given by Jesus Christ, who says, I speak what the Father speaks, I speak. So let's start by going to Matthew chapter 6. And we can cover some of these points fairly quickly. And I hope that you will build on these for your own selves, because it is through the understanding and comprehension and acceptance of life that God has given us that we indeed can live through tragedies and come out on the other end a better person, as Job was, a different person, a changed person, a person who is indeed useful to his Creator, designed by that Creator. Made for a purpose. There is a purpose in all that occurs and happens. Matthew chapter 6 is where we'll start, and I'll break this up into some little sections. I'll start in verse 19 to verse 21. Here the main point is to be rich towards God. Make sure that in your life He is important and pleasing Him is important, and that you're saving up treasures ultimately in heaven. That comes from pleasing God. It comes from being obedient to God, as Irvin pointed out in the sermonette. Verse 19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal. Forest fires can come. You know, other things can occur and happen. One girl who was told to evacuate did, and put all of her stuff, all of her valuables in the car, drove to her boyfriend's house, and left the car parked in the driveway, and somebody broke into the car that night and stole all that she had left in the car. Isn't that amazing? You know, you flee from one tragedy and get hit with another. It's a sorrowful story, but there are some very positive ones, stories too, though. So don't lay up for yourself treasures on earth, but do lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And this is where Job's heart was. Job's heart was with God, with a look to the future. Now it says in Matthew 6, verse 33, seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. That's the key. So be rich towards God. Seek His kingdom. Seek the reason for life. The future that's going to be there for the world and for mankind ultimately, and be a part of that future with the Feast of Tabernacles coming up that ought to be very high in our minds. Going a little further in this Matthew chapter 6 point, verse 22, the lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. Now, light is what Jesus brought. Understanding of the Word of God. Your eye is good. It's sort of as you think. What you think, somebody has said, what you think, you are. If you believe that you are a dope addict, that's what you will be. If you believe that you're always a failure, that's what you will be. If you believe you are a child of God, placed on this earth for a purpose, that's what you will be. That's what you will become. That's the direction your mind will take you, if you believe. So as you think, if your eye is good, if your thoughts are wholesome, if your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. If your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And that is the sad state of people who have no beliefs. They have no anchors to hold onto. The third point is in the next verse. Matthew 6 and verse 24. Keep the right focus in your life. Make sure that you have the right priorities and the right focus. He says in verse 24, Jesus speaking here, the words of God, no one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So we select and choose God's way of life. We choose his yes and no. We choose his principles. We go that way. And we can't straddle the fence. We need to walk as Jesus walked. We cannot straddle the fence. We need to look at the principles that God gives us and work with them. You know, I'm working on the family life series or system that we're developing within the church. And we're talking a lot about divorce and remarriage and how couples get together, how two human beings ought to relate to each other. It's amazing what a broad range of discussions takes place in there. But we are committed to a family. And there are reasons and factors that enter in, of course, a lot of things to think about in what we state and say there. But we do need to commit ourselves to what God says is right. It's like the Sabbath day. You know, Jesus does give us the exceptions of doing a good deed and taking care of our animals and so on. But we need to be careful of how far we take the liberty that God gives us. We cannot serve God and mammon. The fourth point is found just a little bit further down as well, verse 25 to 27. Control your worries. The fourth point is control your worries. It's easy to give you these in a nice little package since they're all close by. Jesus says, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Now, he doesn't say don't think about it. He doesn't say stop going to school or plan for a future. If you're a child, don't get educated, don't be trained. You know, right today, for example, in Kelowna, there are 250 houses burned down. You know, there is a dearth of professional and trained people, tradespeople in those areas. They don't know what they're going to do. There aren't enough men or women, you know, who can be in the construction trades and build and do the electricity and the plumbing and so on. They're really in a bind. They moved to Alberta, I guess, where the jobs were. But there is a real problem. And a person with some training in a trade can have a very good life. We are to plan our futures. We are to teach our children that, you know, today is where you study when you go to school, so that when you grow up, you can be somebody and do something useful and have a very good life and a good income. And we need to teach our children that you can do these things, that you are worthwhile. You know, I had a very sad email message the other day from a lady who sometimes writes me some emails, and she said she was in a store the other day with her daughter doing some shopping, and they were just sort of, I guess, around one side of the clothes rack. And on the other side, there was this grandmother with her little grandson. And this lady saw this boy, and, you know, she's a very tender-hearted person, this particular woman. And she saw the look on the little boy's face, the sad eyes, and the sallow look, and she heard this little boy say to his grandmother, when is mommy coming home? When's my mother coming home? And the grandmother said, she is not coming home anymore. And this little boy, you know, the look on his face, this woman said she burst into tears herself. She wanted to just take him in her arms and take him home with her. And, you know, how can a mother just walk out on her children? And yet people do it, you know, every day. Women, men do too, of course, men and women. Walk out on their children or leave them in some way or another or forsake them. Go to the gambling casinos and blow all the futures for their families and so on. We are to concern ourselves about our children, and we are to teach them to be ready for tomorrow and train them and take them to teach them to do things and teach them that life is wonderful and beautiful if you're willing to work hard, reach out and grab it. So he says, don't worry, don't take the anxious thought, don't agonize over what you'll eat or what you'll drink or about your body. or what you'll put on. You know, our children seem to grow up in this affluent society worrying about the style of clothes and the mode. You know, where was it made and where did you buy it and so on. I never heard of that. You know, I was growing up. My mother sewed my pants. And we had a pair of breeches, leather-seated breeches, RCMP breeches they looked like. You know, I wore them, my brother wore them. You know, they wore them for years. They never seemed to wear out at all. And I never worried about what you put on. So as long as you're neatly dressed and cleanly dressed, you know, that was okay. But nowadays, somehow or other, it's got to be a certain style, has to have a certain tag on it or whatever, you know, or people won't notice you or laugh at you. Somehow it seems like it changes you inside. We're not supposed to worry about that. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? So when this man said to me, when Wayne said, I would have lost everything, how can you think that way? What is everything? And I helped him understand that his house is not everything, and nor is his lovely vehicle and car, and nor is it, or his two boats. You know, none of that is everything to him. You know, his family is much more everything. But his life and his relationship with God, that is everything. And he said, I came that close to praying. It's interesting how quickly we got into that kind of conversation. So I don't stop being a minister even though I'm not here. It says in verse 26, look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather in barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them, and are you not of more value than they? Which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? You can't be smarter by worrying. You can't be more intelligent. You can't do better in exams. You know, I know students, when I went to university, who used to worry about an exam. And they worry and worry and worry. The thing they didn't do enough of was study. If you study for an exam, you never worry about it. You kind of look forward to a challenge. Now, you can overstudy, too. But worrying about it doesn't make you any smarter. Doesn't help you at all. As a matter of fact, it hinders your thinking. Because you don't have ideas coming and you don't think clearly and sharply when you worry. So control your worries. Are you alive? Can you think? Are you breathing? Do you have clothes? Do you have clothes? Do you have food? Then you've not lost everything. You're not in a great tragedy. A fifth point we find in verse 34. Do not cross your bridges until you come to them. Don't take any worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. So you don't take anxious thought. Today is point number four, controlling your worries. Point number five is don't cross the bridges tomorrow until you come to them. People worry about what might happen, not what is happening. So plan ahead and be ready to alter the plans. That's important. Have a goal. And be ready to alter that if you need to. Keep the goal in mind always, but your path to that goal may change somewhat. You know, when I was 24 years old, I was working at Oil Well Supply, driving trucks and lifting heavy metal pieces and so on and so forth, and I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. So I decided I was going to go to university, or go to school, get a trade, do something. And I ended up going to university. That was my goal. Now, what I took at university, that depended on how much money I had. And education didn't have any tuition fees. It was free of charge. So I ended up taking education. Now, it was also an area that I was okay in and was sort of adapted to do and to be, as still I'm doing right now, in a sense. So you plan ahead for a goal, but you may have to alter your plans. And then point number six. Point number six we find in Matthew chapter 7. In verse 7. And that is to keep praying. Always. Keep praying always. Not necessarily about the same problem. You know, Jesus never stopped praying. When he was dying, he didn't pray to Father to remove him from this pain and suffering. He said, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He prayed for those who were crucifying him. He prayed for his mother. He prayed for his disciples. He prayed for the church. He prayed for you and he prayed for me. He did a lot of other things at the moment of his greatest point of suffering. So Matthew 7 and in verse 7, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be opened to you. It may take a while. Job had to wait years before God opened his understanding. Everyone who asks receives. And he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, it will be opened. That's something we need to believe God in and trust Him in. It may be that you cannot or will not get an answer maybe even for the rest of your life? You know, I've had that question in my mind. Why should my wife Joan die at 45 years of age? That's a very young death. I know some of you have suffered terrible losses in your life, and you've surely asked that question. I don't have an answer yet, and I'm sure you don't have an answer yet. I mean a full answer, but that will come. That's a promise from God that He will give you that answer. And when He does, it'll satisfy you. It'll be, as you'll see from His point of view, a blessing ultimately. In the final analysis, it will be satisfying. What man is there among you who asks, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children. You know, people who are not in the church, they know how to do good things. They know how to teach their children discipline and correction. They don't even have to be converted. You know, this man, Wayne, he's got two very fine young boys. This one son of his is the wakeboard champion of Shuswap and Salmon Arm, B.C. Boy, you should see him flip around on that wakeboard. His father takes him out every night. Father and mother and the two boys out in their big boat. Mother's spotting, you know. And this one boy's doing all his flips and so on, you know. And his father rides him out every single night that we've been there. So they really work together as a family. They know how to give good gifts to their children. How much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to you, to those who ask? Therefore, whatever you want men to do for you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. So it's interesting how he wraps that in there, that you too are to be doing something, you see, because all that's occurring and happening to us has something to do with our future. Let's flip over to the book of Hebrews, and keep your hand in Matthew, we're coming back there in a moment. But in the book of Hebrews, chapter 5, I hope I'm coming through clear on these microphones. I realize sometimes I move away just a little bit and back a little bit, and I hope that it's coming through clearly on the cybercasts and so on. I guess a person needs to have a microphone almost attached to your chin or something so you don't move away from it. But Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 5 talks about Jesus Christ. It says in verse 5, So also Christ did not glorify himself to become a high priest, but it was he who said to him, that is God the Father, said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Also in another place, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, this is Christ, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. So God did put us on this earth so that we would suffer certain things. Now, not needlessly, not foolish things, but we will suffer certain things. You suffer the death of your grandparents. You suffer the death of your mother and father. You may suffer your house burning down or suffer a loss of some kind. And hopefully, you know, it won't be great, horrible, and terrible losses, but some have done that too. Some have lost terribly, and I can't think of a greater loss than your children. All of Job's children were lost, and some of you have lost children. And verse 9, having been perfected, you see, it was the suffering that perfected Christ. What did it perfect? How did it? He became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him, called by God as a high priest, according to the order of Melchizedek, of whom we have much to say. It's hard to explain since you've become dull of hearing. The reason he has done that is so that he now knows what humans feel like. How disturbed we can be, and how worried we can be, and how frustrated we can be, and how fearful we can be, how much pain comes upon us. Jesus Christ experienced all of that. He can now be the high priest, our high priest, and intervene for you. And when you cry your real tears, Jesus knows what it's all about, because he too cried tears. Let's go back to Matthew 5. Matthew 5, another way to live our lives, which sometimes have tragedies in it, is to rejoice in life. Rejoice in your living. You know, there's something wonderful about skiing down a hill and taking a nice sweeping turn. Just the G-forces of the turn are just wonderful feelings. I don't mean the kind of G-forces that ends up hitting a tree and getting killed, but just a nice sweeping turn. Something about that is just very pleasing and fulfilling and happy. A lot of other things in life are absolutely wonderful. tackle your problems with energy and zeal. Think about the solutions. That's what we're here for. We're here to learn. Matthew 5 and verse 12. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. In persecution and difficulties and in suffering, rejoice. Because that's how they persecuted the prophets, but your reward in heaven will be great. God hears your prayers, and if he doesn't answer the prayer, or he says no, as with Paul, he wanted to be healed. And you know, Paul resurrected dead people. He healed people in his prayers when God did, of course. But Paul prayed for them and they were healed. And yet Paul had a problem and nothing was done. And he said, I've learned from this. He thanked God for not healing him. Interesting statements. Verse 16, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Your life is to be joyful, not glum. Not a difficult experience. We don't go around with frowns and serious, miserable faces all the time. I remember once, years and years ago, we were lying out on the beach in Elk Island, and these three elderly women, dressed to the hilt, you know, walked past us with their serious frowns. I'm not sure what religion they were, but fully clothed to the ankles, up to the chin, and they looked down at us and were tut-tutting people lying around in bathing suits. And they wondered, what are we doing at the beach then? Why don't you go walk in the bush where nobody goes around in bathing suits? They walk right by the beach there and tut-tutting everybody going along these people in bathing suits. And they looked like their faces were, you know, prunes. They looked sort of like drawn together and unhappy. That's not the kind of religion God teaches. That's not the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to laugh a little and enjoy life and enjoy being together as we do. It's a joy being with God's people. So Matthew 5, then in verse 16, I say verse 20. For I say to you, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not inherit the kingdom of God. We are to learn. You know, little children are marvelous. I've had a great experience with the three youngest children of Rick and Heather. Max and Carolyn and Carl. We ended up going to Ruby Mountain and Ruby Falls and quadding through that area there. And it was marvelous to see these little children just putting energy into learning things, energy into climbing the mountain. You know, as we climbed three-quarters of the way up Mount Cheviot. We actually went to two mountains, Mount Cheviot. And, you know, Carolyn and Max climbed up three-quarters of the way, and everybody who was there was amazed. Those little legs just kept right on going. But you know, they were learning great things. They were learning how to look around them and see and walk, be careful of the rocks and how you come back down. I think Carolyn wore a little hole in her pocket sliding down one part of that mountain. But little children live with great energy. They learn things. You know, I had the trailer parked there, and Max, with the quad on the trailer, that was all together but that high. And, you know, Max couldn't just leave it alone. He had to find a way of climbing onto the trailer and climbing onto the quad and sitting there on the seat of the quad. No, he slipped and fell off, head first into the dirt pile below him, but it was an experience. And you can't stop children from learning, and learning with zeal. I mean, they really want to learn. When we were at the dock there, we were just pulling the boat in, you know, there were three people, grandma, grandpa, and a mother and her son, four people, a little son, and a dog, and a little boy with a dog. What's he going to do with a dog at the lake? He pushed it in the water. Of course he pushed it in the water, you know. Of course. But this was a pampered little dog, his grandmother's pampered little dog, you know. And his grandmother took off after her grandson. You're a bad boy, you know, hurting a little dog like that. And the little dog wasn't hurt. I think he kind of enjoyed being cooled off a little bit, you know, swimming out there and shaking himself. But he was a bad boy. It's an amazing thing, you know. Children have to experience that. They have to learn how to do that. You know, they have to grab a dog by the tail, you know, or do those kind of things. They're refreshing. We can learn so much. But we need to be balanced and aware enough to learn the lessons that make us useful as children of God, just as our little children need to be aware enough to learn the lessons of life from their mother and father and from others in the family. We'll go to 2 Corinthians, and we won't be coming back to Matthew, I don't think, but let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. This is one of my favorite scriptures. It does give us, you know, so much of a reason for the tragedies that do strike us in life. And everything in life isn't a tragedy. I don't mean to say that. It's not. most of life is absolutely marvelous and wonderful. I hope it is for you. I have to say it is for me. You know, I think from the day I was born, you know, I've just been so blessed and so fortunate and so happy. You know, I've skinned my knuckles and done various things like that, but I never did, you know, major damage. Anyway, in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 3, it says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the Father and the mercies and the God of all comfort." Why would you comfort somebody? Because they're in pain. Because they're suffering, because they're hurting, because tragedy has struck them. Now, with this Wayne, you know, I couldn't talk to him directly about God, but I think I did comfort him a great deal when I said, "Hey, what is really important in your life?" I focused on his wife and his two sons. And, you know, and I said, too, that, you know, prayer is important. He's in my own way. Who comforts us, though, in all of our tribulation? And why? Why do we have tribulation? And why does God comfort us in our tribulation? He goes on to say, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. There's a lesson in tragedy. Once you go through that, you know what anybody going through a similar tragedy feels like. I mean, you don't even have to discuss it. You know it, and they know it. You just know. In the kingdom of God, brethren, when people are resurrected, or even after the great tribulation when Christ returns, this world will be in such chaos that people will have nowhere to go and they'll feel betrayed and deceived and lost families. You know, the losses of Job are going to be small compared to the losses some people will be suffering. Who's going to comfort those people? Who's going to go and put their arms around them and give them a hug and say there is hope for the future? If not the children of God who've experienced the tragedies and learned by them and overcome them and learned how to comfort because they too have been comforted. So it's important that you and I understand part of the reason that life is the way it is. That when a tragedy does strike, there are purposes and reasons. So rejoice in this life. There's a great, great lesson here. As the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. Now he's talking here about the ministry. If we are afflicted, it's for your consolation and salvation, which is effective for enduring the same sufferings which we also suffer. So and certainly in Paul's day, the ministry was the prime target of those who were looking for someone to kill and someone to stone and so on. So learn so that you can comfort others. And after the return of Jesus Christ especially, comforters are going to be needed. And you can't be prepared to do that when Christ returns. This is what we learn here and now. This is where we understand and feel the hurt and the pain ourselves. And understanding and feeling that and reaching out to God and getting the comfort and strength and the hope from God allows us then to be able to express that to a large degree later on to others whom we will be then helping. These lessons from God's eyes are vital for every human being. They are very important for us because God sees the future. He sees the resurrections. He sees the great second resurrection, but the great resurrection of those who will be coming in the 100-year span of time. All of mankind, every different religion, every different tragedy you can possibly imagine will be resurrected at that time. Billions of people lost and confused and bewildered and hurt, looking for hope, looking for someone to give them comfort. And God will have billions of his children available to help those people. Point number 8, avoid self-pity. Just avoid it. The woe is me attitude. Nobody loves me. The whole world is against me. Life is miserable. I've got terribly, things are just terribly wrong in my life. My car didn't start today and my boat leaks a little bit, you know, and I lost my water ski and the rope broke. I tangled the rope around the propeller of the boat and had to cut it, actually. But I cut it. But that was all right, because Valerie had her wetsuit on, and she went under the water and untangled it and did all those things. And she's a very obedient wife. Proverbs 23. Avoid the self-pity syndrome. And teach your children to avoid this woe is me. There are solutions to problems in life. We just have to find them. Proverbs 23, beginning in verse 22. Here we read, "Listen to your father who begot you, and do not despise your mother when she is old." So we understand that parents are very important in a child's life. And they are to be respected because of that and loved because of that. Buy the truth and do not sell it. Also wisdom and instruction and understanding. That's what I'm talking about today. Buy this great truth. Don't give it away. Don't ever lose it. Hang on to it. And the wisdom and instruction and understanding that comes from it, the father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise child will delight in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her who bore you rejoice. My son, give me your heart, and let your eyes observe my ways. For a harlot is a deep pit, and a seductress a narrow well. She also lies in wait as for a victim, and increases the unfaithful among men. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaints? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? He's asking all these questions. Are you in trouble? Is things going wrong in your life? Is it all difficulty? And he goes on answering it. Those who linger long at wine, those who go in search of mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, as it sparkles in the cups, when it swirls around smoothly. And at last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. So if you feel sorry for yourself, woe is me, people look for solace somewhere. They look for comfort somewhere. They look for a way out somewhere. And the more sorrowful you are about yourself, the more eager you are to grab anything that comes your way, like a straw. It's so amazing how, you know, we are what we think. And when we think that we're unhappy, we look for solutions. And sometimes the more you feel sorry for yourself, the more you take the wrong solutions. And it's a sorrowful and sad thing to watch and see. So fight life. One day at a time, tackle your problems one piece at a time, but tackle them. Tackle them and fight. Don't just lay down and give up. Point number 9, we find in the book of Ecclesiastes. Point number 9, in verse 2. Here it says, all things come alike to all. That is, the religious and the irreligious, the evil and the good. Similar things happen. They all die. That's one thing that happens. They all die. They all sometimes have sicknesses. They all are subject to forest fires or to wars or to various things like that. There's things that happen. They come alike. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, to the clean, to the unclean, to him who sacrifices, to him who does not sacrifices. As is the good, so is the sinner, he who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Goes on to say in verse 7, in spite of living in a life where tragedies will occur, go and eat your bread with joy. If you've got bread to eat, enjoy it. It's amazing, you know, when you're really hungry, how good a piece of bread tastes. It doesn't have to be the best at all, but boy, does it ever taste good when you're really hungry. If you've got a piece of bread, eat it with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has readily accepted your works. So that's where the strength comes from, always coming back to God. Let your garments be white, and let your head lack no oil. So take care of yourself. You're having a shower here. You're enjoying your food. You're thinking about the things you're able to do. Take care of yourself and live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you, under the sun all the days of your vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. You teach your children that. Do it with your might. There isn't any work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. And so we come to see and understand the importance of verses like that. James goes on to say, faith without works, you can fill the rest of it in, you know what it is dead. So obviously, we are to be doing things, and we're to be doing them joyfully. We're to be doing them with zest and with feelings in our life. You know, when King David was a teenager, he said that God strengthened him, he could kill a lion or a bear or something which came to attack the sheep. But do you think he just sort of pointed at it and zapped it? No, he took a club or a rock or a sling or something to kill it with. So David did his part. And when Goliath came, I mean, David even tried on Saul's armor, didn't he? No, he trusted God completely, but he tried on Saul's armor. And he said, it's just too big for me, too cumbersome. And he still took his sling and he took 5 rocks. And people have all kinds of questions as to why he took 5 rocks. My theory is that he's missed before. He figured good time. He had time for five shots, and that would be it. Anyway, David did act, and he was prepared to act. Point number 10. We can go to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Point number 10. This comes up in a lot of different ways in the Bible, but it is to learn to be content. And I emphasize the word learn, brethren. You know, it's so important to understand this. Learn to be content. Now, I look back on my childhood, and it was so good. It was incredible. We didn't have any inside plumbing in the house. And at minus 30, you went outside to the T.O. outside. And it stunk in the summertime and froze in the wintertime. My brother and I hauled in coal. We only had a coal and wood stove. All summer long, our job was using the Swede saw to cut up logs. Now, if you've ever seen a Swede saw, it's a great big single-bladed saw with a boy on each end. And each one's pulling. And to saw that wood takes a long time and a lot of effort. But we built muscles. We were strong and healthy till this day, maybe because of the Swede saw. I don't really know. A lot of times we didn't have a lot to eat. I know my mother used to save her bread, the dried-up crumbs of bread, and she'd break them up into a bowl and put coffee on it. And sugar. That was sometimes one of our meals. We thought it was great. It was marvelous. So we didn't have all of the new hockey equipment. We'd go fishing for hockey equipment that guys threw away. And we found a pair of skates. We were delighted. Tackleberries. Now they were kind of beat up and so on and so forth. But we taped up the toes and put some felt in the tongue. And we had tacks to skate on. Or some old sticks that some guys threw away. After the hockey games, we'd go around picking up old sticks and put them together so that we could use them. We had a wonderful life. We managed to buy one new bike, finally, after delivering newspapers in the town all this time. My brother then bought an old bike for $5. And it was a real old one. This is a real, real old one. We had a great time with it. The front wheel did fall off once. He went over the front end handlebars of it. But other than that, we rode all over the place. Had wonderful times. When we didn't have fishing rods, we cut willows for rods. But boy, did we have a wonderful life. I would wish every child in this world could have a life like I had as a child. It was absolutely wonderful. Learn to be content. Hebrews, did I read 6:8 for us? Oh, yeah. 1 Timothy 6:8. Having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Let's go to Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13 and 5, verse 5 and 6. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he himself has said, I will never leave you or forsake you, so we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man can do. You know, my first car was about a 1936 Chevrolet. And I was content with that car. Now, the light sort of fell off. And sometimes at night, you'd have to sit on the fender. You had big fenders, though. You could sit on the front with a flashlight, so you knew where you were going. I remember once the windshield wiper stopped working, so the passenger had to sit down on the floor, sort of stick your arm way up underneath the dashboard, and you could work the windshield wipers. But it was a great vehicle. It was a car. I wasn't jealous. I didn't want to have necessarily, I wouldn't have minded an Oldsmobile, but this old Chevy was just fine, and it was okay. Be content and learn to be content. In Philippians chapter 4, a very important lesson for our children. And I hope you teach your children this. I know we tend to spoil our children. We give them everything. If they just sort of point at it, they get it. And we need to teach them to learn to be content sometimes. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11, he says, not that I speak with regard to need, Paul says, for I have learned, and it's an education, brethren. Suffering is an education. I've learned to be content in whatever state I am. I've learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to be abound. I know everywhere and in good things I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to be abound and suffer need. When I grew up as a little boy, in grade 1 and 2 and 3, we were the little Hitlers in town, the only German family there during the war years. So we were little Hitlers. And there was times when we were abased. We were not treated all that well. But I never carried any grudges about it or bad thoughts about it at all. Later on, when I got old enough to play hockey, we only had 11 boys in town, so my brother and I became really important in that town. Of course, scoring all the goals helped too. But But we got to be good friends. As a matter of fact, at the Coal Ranch reunion, I talked to some boys that we played hockey with way back there when I was, 13, 14 years old. I learned, Paul says, everywhere, in verse 12, everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Again, it comes back to the foundation of his learning. Nevertheless, you have done well that you've shared in my distress. And so we, in the church, we strive to help out, whether it is with the Good Works program or the Life Nets or just reaching out to one another and giving each other a hug when we need it. An 11th point, for which I didn't find a scripture, is do not take yourself too seriously. Sometimes we think everybody's watching me. The whole world is watching me. Sometimes experiences in your life make you think that. When I was in grade one, Albert Supsack turned around and talked to me, and both of us ended up sitting at the front steps. I was 5 years old, and I can remember that. And the whole room was watching me. You see, everybody was looking at us, sitting. We were talking up in the front steps over there. But, I laughed about it and can laugh about it till this day. We need to begin to laugh about things. We need to understand about a sense of humor. So don't take yourself too seriously. We figure the whole world is watching when it may not care at all. Sometimes we lose sleep over things that our friends don't even think about or people we associate with. Develop that sense of humor. Laugh sometimes about things. Now, Valerie's good at that. Whenever I have problems, she laughs at me. Doesn't reach out to help me, just laughs at me. I fall out of the boat, and she just kills herself laughing. Got a good sense of humor. And then finally, the 12th point is do count the cost when you have things to do. Let's go to Luke 14. Be sure you do count the cost. That'll allow you to plan, make plans for your life, make plans to ward off tragedies that are unnecessary. Now, this young 16-year-old girl that was killed, I saw the tracks where the car went into the ditch a good 100 yards before the trees, went into the right-hand side of the ditch, and then it went down, went up and over across the road, and then into the trees, a good 100 yards. And I asked myself, on a corner with houses on both sides, how fast was that car going? Couldn't have been going 80 kilometers an hour. There was a young 16-year-old boy who was given a ticket on the high-level bridge in Edmonton. His speed was 146 kilometers an hour on the high-level bridge. I'm thinking that's about the speed of that vehicle that killed this girl. Count the cost. Luke 14 and verse 25. Great multitudes went to Jesus, and he turned and said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his mother and father, wife and children, brothers and sisters, and his own life, he cannot be my disciple." Now, he didn't mean what we think of as hate. He means to love less by comparison. In other words, God has to be first in our life, absolute first. Immediately after that is family. That's why Jesus said, "If your mother, father, brothers, and sisters," that comes right after God, is your family, your children, your husband, your wife, your mother, your father. "Whoever does not bear his cross, whatever difficulties in life gives you, and come after me, cannot be my disciple." Job kept walking after God and learning, and you do and I do. And the disciples did, Paul did. Paul was beaten probably more than anybody. He kept walking after God and learning the vital and very, very important lessons of life. "Which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it?" So it takes preparation. Sometimes you need to say, I haven't got enough. I'll save. I'll work towards it. And we do need to then do that, make sure that we save up and plan ahead, lest after he has laid the foundation, is not able to finish, and all who see it begin to mock the person, saying, "This man began to build and was not able to finish." Or, "What king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for conditions of peace." So there's obviously planning and adjusting and changing that can be done. Count the cost. Plan your course of action in life. And then you will know what to do when you understand what's facing you. And so with these 12 points, brethren, you can adjust them, as I said, or add to them. But obviously God wants you and me to live our life, not ever to run away from it or turn from it. And that takes courage. It takes determination, and it takes learning. It takes an education to know when to rest, to know when to plan to attack. It takes experiences, experiences that we begin receiving even as little tiny children. Don't touch that, it's hot. You ever said that to a little boy or a little girl? Don't touch it, it's hot. And their little other hand is going out there. They're going to touch it, aren't they? But at least you've told them, now it's hot. Now they know it's hot, okay. And they learn by experience. We are a creation of God, not an accident of nature. We are put here for a purpose on this earth, and even though maybe it hasn't been fully revealed to us, trust and faith in God comes in because it isn't always clear. Roll up your sleeves, and life will give you about the same as you invest in your work and your actions. You know, God blesses the doers, not the whiners, not the complainers, not the sitters, not those who just lie in their bed. He blesses the doers. Be a doer. Show your faith and your trust towards God, as James says. Faith without works is dead. And doing that, brethren, we'll be able to face life, the tragedies that will come our way, with an understanding and a strength that will allow you one day to be a source of strength and a source of comfort and a source of love to many, many other human beings. There is a purpose to life.